You're listening to A Closer Look. I'm Monica Goki. Today we bring you a special reporting initiative that comes to us from Sitka, where KCAW reporter Rachel Waldholtz and biologist Ellen Chenoweth sat down together to explore the relationship between humpback whales and the Endangered Species Act. Last month, the federal government proposed removing humpback whales from the endangered species list. Regardless of the final decision, one thing is clear. Without whales and other marine mammals, there might not even be an endangered species list. Waldholtz and Chenoweth start their special report by looking at how one of the nation's most enduring environmental laws emerged from the office of one of its most controversial presidents.
Through our years of past carelessness, we incurred a debt to nature, and now that debt is being called.
I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
And I'm Ellen Chenoweth.
And this is the beginning of the Endangered Species Act.
The great question of the 70s is, shall we surrender to our surroundings? Or shall we make our peace with nature and begin to make reparations for the damage we have done to our air, to our land, and to our water?
That's President Richard Nixon in 1970 laying out an ambitious environmental agenda.
In his 5.5 years in office, Nixon signed the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and in 1973, the Endangered Species Act.
For those of us who associate the Nixon administration with Watergate and Vietnam, this is a little surprising.
Well, and it would be more so if you knew him.
That's Lee Talbot. He was one of the architects of the Endangered Species Act.
President Nixon was not what one could call an environmentalist.
But he was a pretty good politician, and he recognized that there was this groundswell of public support for environmental action. Remember, in the late 60s and early 70s, environmental issues are suddenly in the news.
When people talk about this era, they always bring up Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring.
Right, and that comes out in the early 60s. In 1969, there's the Santa Barbara oil spill, one of the largest in U.S. history. That same year, Ohio's Cuyahoga River catches fire, becoming a national symbol of polluted waters. The first Earth Day is organized in 1970.
Here's all of the constituents are requesting government to do something about the environment. And the great majority of people in Congress didn't really know what environment was.
Nixon gave his staff wide latitude to pursue environmental policy, and they ran with it. Talbot was a senior scientist with the President's Council on Environmental Quality. He knew he wanted to pass a major endangered species law, but he decided to push first for what became the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
And this is the law that makes it illegal to hunt marine mammals, including whales.
It was evident to me that the public didn't really connect with, say, a cod, but they could get excited about a marine mammal. So it seemed to me that we ought to make a major push on whales, and then hopefully go beyond that later on.
And this was a bill that wasn't very popular with the commercial fishing industry or with the federal agencies. But the main obstacle was actually the Department of Defense.
And can we just pause and note that as recently as the late 60s, the Department of Defense was still using sperm whale oil in its weapon systems?
Right. So the fact that some people wanted to ban commercial whaling was literally a matter of national security.
It turns out sperm whale oil could handle really high temperatures and pressure. The military didn't think they could replace it, but Talbot thought differently. He describes a meeting he arranged deep below the White House between representatives of the Joint Chiefs and folks from a couple of the major chemical companies.
I said, well, is it true that it's not possible to produce this? And they both said, no, we can do it. And I said, well, how long would it take you to get it in the adequate amounts? And one of them said, 2 months. And the other said, 6 weeks.
And the Marine Mammal Protection Act passed in 1972. On to the Endangered Species Act. Talbot and his colleagues had learned from earlier endangered species laws how easily they could be circumvented. They were determined that this time the law would have teeth.
What we did was take the administration bill and I went through the whole bill and took out all of the weasel words. So, for example, where it said the secretary may take some action, I changed may to shall. Where it said insofar as practicable, I just took that out. And the net result is a remarkably tough piece of legislation.
The Endangered Species Act passed the House 390-12. It passed the Senate 92-0.
Ted Stevens voted for it. Don Young was a freshman representative at the time, and he voted for it.
And many legislators, many people were surprised when they found that it, you know, gave all species the right to exist.
That's Joe Roman. He's a conservation biologist, and he's written a lot about the Endangered Species Act.
And, you know, that was what made it so radical and so important.
So there are a couple of things that make the Endangered Species Act so powerful. The first is this protection for habitat.
Because the law says you have to protect the species and the ecosystems they depend on, you can't just keep them in zoos. That's really the power of the ESA right now, is those critical habitats.
The other big innovation is including what's called the precautionary principle. At the time, if scientists said harvesting a particular species was driving it to extinction, the burden was on scientists to prove it.
So what I did was rewrite it backwards and put it so that the onus is on those who wish to harvest to prove that it won't threaten them.
So this law was incredibly ambitious. But the question is, has it worked?
If you frame the question, if you judge the success of the Endangered Species Act by the amount of species that have recovered, it's not looking so good. There are only about 30 species of the thousands that have been listed that have been recovered and removed from the list.
But there's also another way to look at it.
If you see the ESA as a law that's intended to prevent extinction, it's been successful in that. Estimates are that the extinction rate since the passage of the Act declined by tenfold.
It's true that they're still on the list, but they're not extinct. And that's a big factor.
And for that, we can thank Richard Nixon.
Like virtually all the great whales, humpbacks were hunted to near extinction in the 20th century. By the mid-60s, researchers think there may have been fewer than 1,500 in the entire North Pacific. But after 40 years of protection, their numbers have recovered. And that brings us to a notoriously difficult question for wildlife managers to answer. Just how many humpback whales are there?
That's the sound of humpback whales singing in Seymour Canal near Juneau. I'm Rachel Waldholz.
And I'm Ellen Chenoweth. These days, humpback whales are a frequent sight in southeast Alaska, but that wasn't always the case.
So I started working in Glacier Bay as a whale biologist in 1991.
That's Chris Gabriel with Glacier Bay National Park.
In those days, I spent a lot more time looking for whales than actually observing them. It was hours and hours on the water, trying to find a needle in a haystack.
Researchers have been monitoring humpback whales in Glacier Bay for 30 years. Gabriel says that when she first started, a survey wouldn't take very long.
But these days, there can be so many whales in one of those survey areas that we can't even photograph them all in a single survey day.
When you're talking about taking an animal off the endangered species list, the obvious first question is, well, how many are there? And with humpbacks, for a while, the only answer scientists had was more than there used to be. But in the mid-2000s, researchers launched a massive international effort to get a more precise number for humpbacks in the North Pacific.
The project was called SPLASH, and it involved more than 400 researchers in 10 countries.
In order to understand humpback whales in the North Pacific, we had to go everywhere that we thought they might be. And that was all over the Pacific Rim and even out in the middle, you know.
That means looking for humpbacks from Central America to the Bering Sea and from the Gulf of Alaska to the Philippines. But how do you count whales?
So scientists use a system called mark and recapture. This is one of the primary methods used by biologists to estimate population size. Normally, you actually trap animals, tag them, let them go, and then a little while later, try to capture them again.
But obviously, it's a little hard to do that with whales.
Well, in some ways, it's actually easier with whales because they come pre-marked. Each whale tail, or the fluke, is about 15 feet wide, and they're really distinct, so you can use them like fingerprints.
So what we do is go out in a boat, and when the whale shows its tail as it dives down beneath the water, we take a photograph, and we compare that photograph to all the other whales we've ever seen.
This is called fluke matching, and the SPLASH researchers collected photos of 8,000 different flukes. And so that's literally sort of sitting there with a photograph in your hand, flipping through pages and pages of fluke photos.
Yep. That's
what it is. It may sound frustrating, but when you match a whale, it's
There's no feeling like it, Rachel.
That's right.
So how do you go from matching fluke photos to estimating the size of a population?
Well, the math here is pretty intuitive. It's like if you run into someone in a big city, you know you're not likely to see them again. But if you run into someone in a small town, you know that you are likely to see them again, just by chance. And that's what the biologists are doing. If they see the same whales over and over again, they assume that the population's probably pretty small. But if they're seeing new whales all the time, then it might be a larger population.
So using that logic, scientists could go from 8,000 fluke photos to an estimate of how many whales are in the whole North Pacific.
Which is 21,000. 21,000 humpback whales in the North Pacific in 2006, the last year Splash collected data.
We went into Splash not knowing how many whales there were, so it's hard to say whether we were surprised or not that there were that many. But I know that the Splash effort was geographically very broad and went into places where we had never really tried to study humpback whales before.
The researchers also collected DNA samples, and they found differences among the different feeding grounds.
For example, an area like Southeast Alaska has a particular signature, a genetic signature, that you can look at, and it's discernibly different from the genetic makeup of the whales in, for example, California, Oregon, and Washington.
But they also found that the different populations sometimes mix. For example, researchers knew that the humpbacks that feed in Southeast Alaska in the summer generally breed in Hawaii during the winter. But it turns out some of those whales also go to Mexico. Some go to Japan.
And while whales in Southeast Alaska seem to be thriving, that's not true everywhere.
In particular, the whales in the western part of the North Pacific, the whales that migrate between Russia and Okinawa and the Philippines, that's quite a small population, and the migratory connections between those areas are really poorly understood.
And there are still more insights coming out of Splash. As Gabriel says, the data analysis lives on. But there's one thing in particular that you can do with this data.
Once you know how many humpback whales there are now, you're one step closer to figuring out how many there used to be before commercial whaling.
But to get there, you also need to know how many humpbacks were killed during whaling. This is biologist Paul Wade.
We knew that the Soviet Union had falsified whaling records in the North Pacific, but it wasn't clear that we were ever going to be able to get at the real numbers because we thought the records would be lost. And then it turns out a lot of them were not lost.
That's our next story. Data hidden in a potato cellar, an archive in eastern Russia, and the secret history of Soviet whaling in the North Pacific. Do you figure out how many humpbacks there were before whaling? You take the number of humpbacks killed during commercial whaling, and you add that back to the current population, while taking into account things like population growth.
So all you really need is a good, complete, and accurate record of the whaling numbers, how many whales were killed.
That's Paul Wade. He's a biologist with the National Marine Mammal Laboratory.
That can be the most difficult part.
My name is Yulia Ivashenko.
Ivashenko is also a biologist at the National Marine Mammal Laboratory in Seattle.
She spent years studying the secret Soviet history of whaling.
In the North Pacific, industrial whaling was a 20th century phenomenon, and it was conducted by just a few countries, especially the Soviet Union and Japan.
And by 1946, the whaling nations had signed on to form the International Whaling Commission.
It set limits on how many whales could be taken and what kind.
And there's tons of records. But the problem is that for a long time, the records were wrong.
Under the Soviet system, every industry had targets to meet.
And that was why the Soviet whalers, they would go and try to kill as many whales as possible. Because if you kill many whales and you reach your target number, you will get a very nice bonus as a salary.
And the more whales you kill, the more bonus you get. So it was way more important to beat those targets than to abide by whaling regulations.
So in this regard, Soviet whalers just ignored everything. So they were killing any whale they wanted and in any place they wanted.
And then they'd lie to the whaling commission. Now, some scientists outside the Soviet Union suspected this was happening, but they couldn't prove it until a chance meeting in the early 90s.
So what happened was there was this American biologist, Bob Brunel, and he's talking to his Russian colleague, a guy named Alexei Yoblikov. And he's basically just complaining about how little biological data there is for right whales.
And mentioning that, Yablokov actually said that, oh, I can provide you with a lot more of biological data on the right whales. So Bob asked, actually, so how many are you talking about? Is it 5, 10, 15? He said a few hundreds.
And that's how it started to come out. It turned out that most of these boats were keeping two sets of records. The falsified version would go to the Whaling Commission, but the true catch records were also preserved. After the fall of the Soviet Union, it became possible to make those numbers public. In 1994, Yablokov published the first paper laying out the true scale of Soviet whaling, and it totally stunned people, because these numbers are huge. In 60 years of Soviet whaling in the Southern Ocean, so that's all the water south of the equator, they killed 330,000 whales, but they only reported 185,000. That's just over half. In one season in the North Pacific, the Soviet fleet caught over 15,000 sperm whales. Ivashenko says a single boat could process up to 200 whales in a day.
Just staggering, we have anything alive in the ocean left.
Soviet scientists went to heroic lengths to save the real data. Ivashenko tells the story of Dmitry Tormasov. He was a biologist with the fleet, and his job was to organize these documents called whale passports. They basically had information on every individual whale that was killed, exactly the kind of information that Bob Brownell was after for right whales. After the data was analyzed, the passports were usually destroyed, but he held on to them, storing them in his potato cellar. And because of stories like that, by the mid-2000s, scientists had managed to piece together pretty accurate records for the Southern Ocean, which is where the most intense whaling took place. But until recently, the numbers in the North Pacific were still a mystery. Then Ivashenko took a trip to Vladivostok.
So I wasn't expecting much.
Ivashenko went there to visit scientists who'd worked on the ships, and they suggested she visit a public archive.
And then I found this pile of different kinds of reports.
And those reports included true catch numbers from boats in the North Pacific, sitting there in a dusty public archive in eastern Russia.
I knew I found the treasure.
Ivashenko has been back 4 or 5 times. So far, she estimates the Soviet fleet killed 190,000 whales in the North Pacific, mostly sperm whales, and only reported 169,000. Those are smaller numbers than in the Southern Ocean, but there were fewer whales to begin with. And because the population in the North Pacific was much smaller, Ivashenko says the impact was actually larger.
In the case of humpback whales, she estimates that the Soviets took about 7,000, and most of that in the space of just 3 years.
And this is the missing piece. Literally, the math people have been waiting for Ivashenko's numbers to plug into their models. And once they run those models, we'll have a good estimate of how many humpbacks roamed the Pacific before industrial whaling.
Last month, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration recommended delisting the humpback whale from the endangered species list. If the humpback is indeed delisted, it'll only be the second time the agency has ever done so for a marine mammal. In the last installment of their series, Sitka reporter Rachel Waldholtz and biologist Ellen Chenoweth ask what's at stake for the humpbacks, and for us.
Reporting, there was one phrase we heard over and over and over.
The recovery of humpback whales in the North Pacific is really an ESA success story.
The Central North Pacific humpback whales are a great conservation success story.
To me, it's just one of the thrilling things and a really important positive thing to have these success stories.
That's Doug Vincent Lang, who petitioned on behalf of the state of Alaska to take some humpbacks off the list, Rebecca Noblin of the Center for Biological Diversity, which wants to keep humpbacks on the list, and Barb Taylor of NOAA, who walked us through how this whole listing-delisting process works.
So everyone agrees on a few key points. First, the major threat to humpbacks is gone, and it's not coming back anytime soon. Here's Taylor.
Well, the threats that put them on the endangered species list to begin with was whaling. Quite literally, the seas were red in 1973 when all the great whales were put on the endangered species list. It was a shocking bloodbath that was going on.
The International Whaling Commission has had a moratorium on commercial whaling since 1986 and on humpbacks since 1966. And even if humpbacks are taken off the endangered species list, and if the moratorium were lifted, it would still be illegal to hunt them in U.S. waters under the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
The second point everyone agrees on is that there are way more whales than there used to be. We don't know exactly how many humpbacks survived commercial whaling, but one number that scientists throw around is 1,500 humpbacks in the entire North Pacific in the late 1960s. Now scientists estimate there are 21,000 humpbacks in the North Pacific, And worldwide, there may be over 60,000.
And the key thing to remember about the Endangered Species Act is it's interested in just one thing. Is this animal at risk of extinction if these protections are removed? And this is where people start to disagree.
So humpback whales no longer face commercial whaling, but they do face a number of environmental stressors that are increasing. The biggest of which are climate change and ocean acidification.
That's Rebecca Noblin from the Center for Biological Diversity. She says humpbacks also face threats from ship strikes, entanglement in commercial fishing nets, and noise pollution.
But the state of Alaska says the population is now resilient enough to handle these threats.
We think it's time to celebrate the success and move on and delist this species.
Doug Vincent Lang is the former director of the State Division of Wildlife Conservation under former Governor Sean Parnell. The problem is that sometimes both sides are right. Taylor says it's maddening for biologists to have to assess the average risk of species that span the globe.
I often liken it to asking a doctor who has three patients, one that's going to run the marathon the next day, one that has a headache, and one that is on life support, and asking that doctor, so give us the average health of your patients.
And humpbacks might be in that position. The whales that feed around Southeast Alaska appear to be thriving. But on the other side of the Pacific, off the coast of Asia, the population is much smaller.
Right, and one solution is to break a species into what's called distinct population segments, and then just delist one segment. NOAA was already 4 years into a review of humpback status worldwide when they received a petition in 2013 from a Hawaiian Fishermen's Alliance, asking the agency to consider just delisting the North Pacific stock, so all humpbacks in the Pacific north of the equator.
And then this year, the state of Alaska suggested yet a third option, for NOAA to delist just the central North Pacific stock, which includes most of the whales that feed in Alaska and breed in Hawaii.
Noblin says that's easier said than done.
It's hard to imagine how you can remove protections for these whales without also putting other more at-risk populations in harm's way.
That's because these populations sometimes mix, especially on feeding grounds like in Alaska, so it can be kind of tricky to manage them differently.
But even if they are delisted, humpbacks, unlike, say, wolves or spotted owls, would still be protected by one of the most powerful wildlife conservation laws in the world, the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Vincent Lang says that double layer of protection was useful once, but now it's a burden for industries that operate in humpback territory.
And again, we don't think that's necessary for a species that isn't at the risk of extinction.
The thing is, most activities prohibited under the Endangered Species Act would still be prohibited under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So we asked Barb Taylor at NOAA, what would really change?
Will there be hunting whales if they come off the list?
Oh, certainly not.
Okay, and then will we be able to buy humpback whale blubber in our sushi restaurants?
Oh, no. No, definitely not.
We have a lot of whale watching around here, and there's a approach limit. And I was wondering if that's likely to change. Will we be able to get right up next to humpback whales in whale watching boats?
No, and again, those regulations are all under the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
In other words,
I don't think it will actually affect any human activity.
All right, then why does it even matter?
Well, it is the right thing to do.
If the science warrants it. She didn't take a position on humpbacks because she's not on the review committee. But she did say that it makes it harder to list species when people think that they'll likely stay listed forever. And Noblin of the Center for Biological Diversity doesn't necessarily disagree. But she says the time isn't yet ripe for humpback whales.
You know, when you're looking at a species that was, you know, in fairly recent history on the brink of extinction, combined with an environment that's changing really rapidly, I think it's important to maintain, you know, all levels of protection right now.
As for Taylor, she says that when a species comes off the list, it's a clear signal that the protections have worked.
You know, I just did some interviews both in Mexico and in New Zealand where, you know, people are saying, well, it's hopeless. And I'm saying, it's not hopeless. You know, I've had the great pleasure to actually witness that with both humpback whales and bowheads, and it makes me have, I think, the perseverance that you need to stick through these decades of struggle for these species that really are on the brink.
And she says that's why you need success stories.
Mm-hmm. You've been hearing from reporter Rachel Waldholtz and biologist Ellen Chenoweth. This investigative report on humpback whale delisting was produced at KCAW in Sitka. Last month, NOAA proposed taking the humpback whales off the endangered species list. 45 years after the whales were first listed, federal scientists say that most humpback populations, including those common in Alaska, are stable and growing. NOAA's proposal to delist would split the species into 14 populations and take 10 of those populations off the endangered species list entirely. Among those slated for delisting is the Central North Pacific stock, which breed in Hawaii and feed in Southeast Alaska. The public now has 90 days to comment on the proposal, and NOAA has about a year to review public input and issue a final rule. For more developments on this story, stay with us online at alaskapublic.org for up-to-date news on the verdict. Thanks for tuning in with us today on A Closer Look. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Gokey.